Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you as usual from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK, and welcome to a slightly different kind of programme than our usual interview, or even the occasional debate that we've had here from time to time, because today we have our first Q&A session, or I'm going to call it a quasi-Q&A session. I'll explain what I mean by that in a few minutes from now. Because we are joined, I'm very pleased to say, by none other than David Robertson, who is a very well-known and much sought-after Christian speaker, debater, and minister here in the UK, who appears, I think, fairly regularly on Premier Christian Radio's Unbelievable programme with Justin Brearley, which I know some of you listen to, and many other media outlets as well. And as he says on his blog, the We Flee, which I'll have to ask him about that in a minute. He does a lot of writing in newspapers and magazines such as The Scotsman and Christianity Today. And he is indeed the author of several books as well, including perhaps most famously The Dawkins Letters from 2007. And a book which I know he particularly would like to mention, Magnificent Obsession, and I think most recently Engaging with Atheists, Understanding Their World, Sharing Good News from 2014. And just to put the proverbial icing on the cake, I read that David was in fact voted in 2014 and 2015 as one of the top 100 most influential Christians in the UK by online voters at Archbishop Cranmer's top 100 list. So David, welcome to the show. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you. It's a privilege, even though I'm full of man flu, which your female listeners will have no sympathy for, but all men will completely understand the devastating consequences of it.
I completely understand, yes. I think I'm coming down with man flu myself, yes. Do you want to just tell us about Magnificent Obsession? Because you say that you're particularly happy with that book.
Well, yes, because the Dawkins Letters was written as a response, amazingly enough, to Richard Dawkins. I'm not particularly well known, despite your introduction, and so we were really surprised it became a kind of bestseller. And the other great new atheist, if you like, was Christopher Hitchens. He had a book called God Is Not Great. And so I wanted to write a response to that, and it came out of an atheist saying to me that I destroyed his atheism, but what did I believe? And I told him I believed primarily because of Jesus. And he said, yeah, but who's Jesus? So Magnificent Obsession was, I wanted to give him a book about Jesus, and I couldn't find one that would fit a kind of under 40 postmodern European American, whatever. And so I wrote one. That's what Magnificent Obsession is. It's an introduction to Jesus Christ from a historical, biblical, contemporary perspective to people who, you know, if you say believe in Jesus, it's answering the question why, you know, who is he? And once you know who he is, then you've got the why answered.
And is there part of that as well, answering the question, did he even exist?
Not really. I mean, I'm a historian, and it's a somewhat bizarre. Once you get to the level of debating if Jesus even existed, you're really at the level of debating is the earth flat or round. There aren't many reputable historians who would doubt Jesus actually existed. And I tend not to bother with that. I mean, I mention it, I think, in one paragraph. But even people like Bart Ehrman, who's notoriously opposed to the New Testament, will acknowledge that the historical evidence is that someone called Jesus certainly did exist.
Sure, yeah. I only asked because we did in fact have Ken Humphreys on the programme doing a debate a while ago, so I did bother to do that. I haven't bothered to deal with the flat earth issue. I might have a debate about that one day, but no, probably not. Yeah. No, probably not, actually. So before we get into the questions, why did you call your blog The We Flee?
Well, it goes back to Richard Dawkins, because what happened with the Dawkins letters was I was in Costa's in Waterson's, and I'd read Richard Dawkins' stuff, and I knew he had this book called The God Delusion. I knew it'd be an attack on Christianity. And I steeled myself. I bought myself a cappuccino, and I took the book off the shelf, read chapter one, put the book back, didn't buy it, and came back every day reading a chapter at a time. It cost me far more in cappuccinos than it would have cost me to buy it. Since then, I've bought about three copies, and I was so stunned by it. And what I mean by that was how dumb it was. I'd expected it to be way more intelligent than it is. And I thought, if my 13-year-old daughter can answer this, I would disown her. So I wrote, at that time I had a column on the Free Church webpage. And so I just wrote an open letter to Richard Dawkins. Now, it was a stylistic device. I mean, I've written to the Queen and Obama and others as well. Yeah. Didn't expect anything, but within 2 days, I was getting lots and lots of emails from atheists. Now, I was so impressed because Free Church people don't read the Free Church website, and all these atheists were reading it. And then I discovered what happened. Somebody wrote me, and an atheist, and apologized for all the names I was being called. So I wrote back and asked him, what are you talking about? And he said, oh, on the Dawkins website. I didn't even know there was a Dawkins website. Mm-hmm. So I went to it, and the webmaster had posted my letter on the front page. By the time I got to it, there'd been 700 responses. At least a third of them were immensely vitriolic. I mean, I was always amused by the new atheists, you know, that their motto is there is no God and I hate him. And I joked to somebody, do you know this? If I'd gone on the Al-Qaeda website and said something bad about Muhammad, I wouldn't have had such a reaction.
Right. Bring back the old atheists, I think. Good
happens. Yeah. So I'm Scottish, and there's a word we use called throne. So I thought, right, I'm going to go for it. So I responded to a lot of the posts. By the time I left, there were 7,000 comments, which was by far the most they'd had. Oh. Dawkins banned me himself several times. I kept coming back under a pseudonym. He made an enormous mistake. I ended up writing a response to each of his chapters, which then was published as the Dawkins Letters. He persuaded one of his acolytes to write a review of myself, Alistair McGrath. It may have been John Lennox. I can't remember who. You know, there's three or four of us. And she made the mistake of saying that my book was by far the best of what they called the flea books. So I was so amused with this. We put it on the cover of the book, and Dawkins was fuming. And then he banned me again, and I came under a pseudonym back onto the site. He'd called me a flea, and in Scotland, my church, the Free Church of Scotland, is known as the Wee Frees. And I just called myself the Wee Flea, thinking that he wouldn't know any Scottish church history. And he didn't, and I got away with that for a while. But I liked the tag so much that I just kept it. So that's how he said that myself and McGrath and John Lennox and others, that we were like, he quoted I think it's Yeats who said, or W.H. Auden, that they were like fleas living off a dog's back. I mean, it was quite funny, yes. Because this is from a man who charged £20 for a book that was rehashing old arguments about God, the non-existence of God, which made him a fortune. Those of us in Christian published realized that, you know, we never going to make a fortune. So, I mean, we didn't do it for the money. I certainly didn't anyway.
So the idea is that you were doing that in order to gain attention for yourself, and you're this insignificant person who comes along and just sucks a little bit of blood out of his great...
Well, he was really arguing that we were trying to make money, which was hilarious. Right. I mean, that just didn't happen. I mean, what I was delighted, there was one atheist on his website who was actually converted through the exchange that we had, which is wonderful.
Oh, excellent.
And he actually wrote, David Robertson was accused of being a liar for Jesus. I couldn't find any lies. And then he was accused of drawing attention all the time to himself. And he said, I realized that he wasn't drawing attention to himself. He was drawing attention to Jesus. So, I mean, he got it.
Yeah. You mentioned Free Church. You are a Free Church minister, is that right?
Yeah, Free Church, for your listeners, it has different meanings in different contexts. Right. We're actually a Presbyterian church like the Church of Scotland, but we are the Free Church of Scotland, which means that we are free from state interference. We are Presbyterian. We're not independent. I mean, if you're in the States, for example, probably the nearest church would be like the Presbyterian Church of America or the Orthodox Presbyterian Church.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean you don't have any denominational connections.
Yes, well, that's quite funny, because when I hear people say, I'm a free church, I don't have any denomination, I just go, yeah, well, that's your denomination.
I see what you mean, sure. And you're also director of SOLAS. What's that about?
SOLAS, Centre for Public Christianity. SOLAS is a Gaelic word meaning light. Uh-huh. It started because of the Dawkins letters and a well-known politician in Scotland who was actually the leader of the Scottish National Party. Read the book, came into the church and became a member with us and a believer. Mm-hmm. And he at one point said, David, you've got a fantastic message in the church. But he said, you're just rubbish at getting it out. And he meant the whole church. And he said, you need to get it into the public sphere. So following, there's something by an Anglican guy in Sydney called John Dixon, called the Centre for Public Christianity. Yeah. We almost wanted to become a branch of them, but then we decided to do our own thing, borrowed the name, give it a cool Gaelic title. And that's what we do. I've just got Dr. Andy Bannister from Ravi Zacharias Ministries, who's just come to take charge of it now. But for a number of years, I led that myself. And what we do is we do evangelism, especially cafe evangelism, coffee shop evangelism. Produce a lot of online materials. Right. We do training for Christians in what we call persuasive evangelism. We don't like calling it apologetics. The big thing as well is that we try and get into the secular media, and that has been relatively successful.
Mm. Well, it's interesting you mentioned that organisation there in Australia, because I actually have been in touch with them and use some of their materials on the website, so there is that connection there. You mentioned about going into the public square there. You have had a bit of a run-in with Tesco recently, haven't you?
Yes, that was an interesting one. Will I tell you about it?
Oh, go on, briefly.
Go briefly, yeah. We were asked by a church called Hope Church in Coatbridge near Glasgow to go and do one of these cafe-type events. And they asked Tesco's if they could use their cafe, because it was a big cafe. Mm-hmm. And the local management said, oh, we're absolutely delighted. Mm-hmm. Put up a poster and so on. And we had a small area where they opened it specially, where we could have taken about 20 or 30 people. And the larger area, we could have taken 150. As we were driving down to go to that, we got a phone call from the organizer saying, you're not going to believe this, but after being booked for 2 months, Tesco's have pulled the plug. So I said, why? And he said, well, the manager's really upset, but she had mumbled something about equalities. And then the corporate manager came on from Tesco headquarters somewhere and said, oh, it was against, you know, they didn't know what it was, they didn't know how many people and all this kind of stuff, which was nonsense. And eventually he said, it's against Tesco's values. So, I mean, I know what happened. Somebody contacted them to complain, probably saying something like, you know, we're homophobic or anti-equality or something. Right. The subject we were speaking on was, does religion cause strife? And basically, Tesco's just banned us.
Right.
So I challenged Tesco's on that, and they issued a statement which was, how do they say in parliamentary terms, economical with the truth, saying that they had advised us to find a bigger venue and so on, and they had done nothing of the sort. That's not why they pulled the plug.
Right. I thought it had something to do, at least as far as they were saying, something to do with the numbers involved. They thought it was going to be 30-ish, and it was turned out to be a couple of hundred or something. Right. It was a rumour I heard.
No, they had, well, first of all, they had no idea how many people were going to come, and we knew that, and we told them that.
Right.
Their cafe could easily have taken 150, and it would have been great business for them. The cafe itself was opening out with its normal hours. There was no problem locally. It was the corporate management. They weren't concerned about numbers. Mm. And it would have been wonderful to have had a situation where we had to turn people away because there weren't enough chairs. We weren't going to overcrowd the place. Great publicity for them. No, they didn't cancel it because of numbers.
So it was another one of those political correctness kind of cases, I guess.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I'll go on the BBC. I remember one time being on a BBC program that was live, and the presenter started laughing in between a piece of music. And I said, why are you laughing? She said, David, do you mind if I read this out? And she gave me some of the mail she'd been getting, emails, immediate emails, which were full of vitriol and bitterness. Mm. And she said, you haven't said anything yet. She said, this is really funny. You know, they're ranting and raving against you about not being tolerant. And she said, it's so intolerant. I mean, it was so funny. But it's quite normal. You know, people ban you in the name of tolerance. You know, it's a strange, weird world. And that's one of the things that we challenge. I mean, I do a lot of debating with atheists and discussions and so on. But can you imagine, I mean, ironically, the subject was on strife and tolerance, really. And I was going to argue that religion does cause strife. In fact, I did argue it because we went and held it in a nearby church. I did argue it, that religion causes strife and trouble. But the notion that Tesco's, I mean, Tesco's would not have banned, let's say it had been the local LGBT group, or dare I say it, if it had been even the local Muslim group, I don't think they would have banned it.
What does one call it? The liberal tyranny? I don't know. We've certainly talked about that kind of thing quite a bit on the show, and I think things seem to be going more in that direction.
I mean, I experience it all the time. I mean, it's constant hate mail and lots of other things, and it's really quite disturbing, actually, the way that it's going, that in the name of tolerance, we're becoming a more intolerant society.
Yeah, it's very Orwellian indeed. Okay, well, I think we ought to move into this Q&A, or as I said, a quasi-Q&A time. And I'm saying that because essentially what I've done is to compile a list of comments and questions that have come into the show over the last couple of years. And it's quasi because I've slightly reworded some of those questions and I've reframed some of the comments to make them into questions. So that they're sort of mostly from listeners, but expressed in my style, if you like. So I've chosen questions about Christianity, or theism more generally, and the Bible. And I'm putting these to you cold. You have no idea, do you not, what I'm going to ask you?
I have no idea, no. Absolutely. I prefer it that way, actually.
Yeah. And I'm going to say now that I think some of them are pretty straightforward to answer. Some of them are rather more tricky to answer. And I think one or two of them are actually quite amusing. So I'm going to be very interested to see how you respond to those particular ones.
Yeah, okay, yeah, sure.
And as I say sometimes on the podcast, for some of the time, I'm going to play the part of devil's advocate, because obviously the question questioners are not here to follow up on your responses.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm going to play that part, and I'm making that very clear now because I don't want people, do not email me and say, you know, why are you against David all the time? It's just because I'm playing that particular part to bring out the discussion as best I can. So is that okay with you? Does that work, David?
Oh, that's fine with me. I mean, and you'll probably get them emailing and saying, why aren't you hard enough on him?
Yeah, probably.
So you do what you want. Yeah, I don't mind at all.
I can only do my best. I'll try and put my atheist hat back on because I was for a time some kind of, you know, questioning atheist anyway. Okay, so here goes. So question number one here, I'm saying, is a kind of logic question. So it is this. Believers in God argue that God created the universe. Okay, but who created God?
Well, if you'd read the Dawkins letters, then you'd find that I've so little patience for that question, because, and I'll tell you why. When I read Dawkins' The God Delusion, I think it's for the first three or four chapters, he kind of builds up like he's climbing up a mountain to this big crescendo question. And then I think it's in the fifth chapter, he says his big argument against God is, who created God?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question that a three-year-old will ask me. It's a question that a 14-year-old teenager in a school who's trying to be smart will ask me. What astounded me was that a professor from the University of Oxford could ask such a question. And the reason is because it's so ignorant. And I'm sorry for being so rude in that sense, but no Christian believes in a created God. So the question's completely redundant. We just simply say God is uncreated. It doesn't make any sense to ask. It's like asking, who made the square circle? We don't believe in a square circle, and we don't believe in a created God. By very definition, God is uncreated. Now, people say, oh, well, come on. We've only got three options. And your first option is one that Stephen Hawking seems to hold, which is somewhat bizarre, that the universe created itself out of nothing at no time, which is just bizarre. The only real two options, John Lennox in his book, God's Undertaker, at the end just puts it very simply, that either your mind came out of uncreated matter or it came from another mind. And the notion that there's an eternal lump of rock or mass of gas of something, the matter is eternal, or there is a personal eternal God. And both of these require a degree of faith. I think it's much more logical to believe in an uncreated eternal God than it is to believe that everything came from eternal, mindless matter. So that would be my answer to that one.
Okay, well, obviously, speaking as myself, I agree with you, but speaking as not myself, so I'm going to say to you, well, isn't this really a case of special pleading, which is a fallacy?
No.
You know, say that God's uncreated. Let me just give you an example,
yeah,
because you could say, right, the universe was brought into being by an invisible supercomputer. And so you could then say, but where did that supercomputer come from? And I could just say, well, it's a special supercomputer because it's an uncreated special computer. Isn't that fallacious reasoning?
No, because if you had basically an uncreated special computer that who was personal and so on, you're talking about God. You know, I mean, by definition, again, you're a computer is something that's created, that's made. So I don't think it's fallacious reasoning at all. People who believe in the eternity of matter do so on the basis of faith. I mean, one of the biggest problems that's ever occurred for atheists was when the Big Bang was discovered, because it showed that the universe had a beginning.
Mm.
And now, of course, we've got people saying, oh, we've got multiverse, so that gets around that. They try, you know, I call it ABGism, anything but God syndrome. You know, we've got to find some other way of explaining this. It just doesn't make any sense.
Okay, so if I put my own hat back on, then are you basically saying something like something must exist necessarily because we're here? Something just has to exist necessarily, and there are these two options: is either the physical universe, or there's that which brought the physical universe into being, and it just looks like the universe does not exist necessarily. It looks very contingent. It looks made. Is that basically what you're saying? So you end up with,
well, it's not even that it looks made.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the argument from design, although I think that's a phenomenal one, and I think particularly in terms of the constants of the universe. But if you want to start with the premise, I mean, unless you really want to go mad. I mean, if you want to go mad, you can start thinking, am I really here? Am I a dream? Am I plugged into the Matrix? You know, you can play those mind games if you want. But let's...
Well,
but,
am I?
But let's assume, yeah. Let's assume that you're not having a dream just now, that you're not plugged into the Matrix, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. Let's assume there is some rationality to the universe and some order. Making these kind of assumptions, you then are going to say, there is matter, I am here, there is reason, there is morality, there's a whole bunch of other things. Where do all these things come from? It's not that I start with God. It's that it seems to me impossible to end up with anything other than God without being completely illogical.
Okay, well, let's move to the second question I've got here, which is a kind of science-y, anthropology kind of question, really. So here it is. Ancient human beings had no idea about geology, biology, astronomy, and evolution. So it's understandable that they had to make up gods to keep themselves content. So why shouldn't we think that belief in God is just some kind of hangover of those primitive beliefs?
Because the person who's asking that question is asking with the presuppositions and the arrogance that somehow we as human beings have progressed. So I will get people who are barely literate telling me that because they live in the 21st century, they know far much more and are much more progressive and much more advanced than Socrates and Plato and the ancient Greeks, or Moses and David and the ancient Hebrews, or the Zoroastrians, or the ancient Chinese, and so on. I mean, it's a fallacy. The question's based on a fallacy in terms of, oh, we've progressed so much more. Actually, the ancients did know a fair bit about geology and biology as well. The interesting thing there is the only way you can argue for progression is in terms of science.
Okay.
That we understand more about some things than we do about others. Mm-hmm. You cannot argue for progression in terms of morality, literature, arts, and so on.
But to be fair to the questioner, he is actually, or she is, just talking about science, geology, biology, astronomy, and evolution.
Yes, but they're surrounding it with presuppositions which assume, because they didn't know this, I mean, this is the atheist version of human history, and it's a very potted version, but we emerged from the primordial swamp. Somehow we became conscious, sentient beings, though we don't know where consciousness came from. We looked up at the sun and we didn't know what the sun was because we were ignorant, and so we worshipped it, though how we knew to worship, nobody answers where the religious instinct comes from. We became polytheists because we worshipped the wind and tribal gods and gods of the trees and so on. And then along came the Jews and the Zoroastrians and then the Christians and the Muslims, and we became monotheists. And now human beings advanced to becoming atheists because they realize there's no God at all, because the blessed Saint Darwin showed us that we all evolved. And that's the grand narrative. I mean, it's not true. It's a myth that suits some people to believe it. I think you can destroy it in so many different areas. I mean, for me, the question itself is presupposing that we're progressing. It's presupposing that we know more, and it's presupposing that the more we know, the less likelihood there is for God. I mean, I spoke of science of the gaps. They're saying God of the gaps. So they're saying, we say we don't understand it, therefore we'll say it's God. But the more we understand, the less room there is for God. Well, whereas Francis Collins, who was the head of the Human Genome Project, began as an atheist, one of the top scientists in the world. He was converted. And in his book, he talks about how we believe not because of what we don't know, but because of what we do know. So I would just completely reverse the question. And I would say even now, scientific discoveries now point more towards God. David Wilkinson of the University of Durham, who's one of the top physicists, astrophysicists in the country. I heard him give a lecture in St. Andrews University in which he was asked, are you saying then that the universe and its fine-tuning and so on proves God? And he said, no, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that it points to God. And I think recent discoveries like the human genome, DNA, fine-tuning of the universe, Big Bang, they all point towards God. They don't prove, because you can't prove anything, especially to a skeptic.
Okay, well, let me slightly reword it then. So we could say, I mean, you've admitted yourself that it is true that science has progressed. Okay, so maybe other areas of human endeavor have not so much, but science, we agree, has progressed. And there are many causes for things that were previously attributed to deities, and now we accept that many of those things are now explained by natural law. We should expect that process to continue. So perhaps some of the things that you've suggested there, including fine-tuning, might one day be explained purely materialistically. So should we ever then accept God as an explanation for anything?
Well, that's an interesting one, because what someone is doing there is they're not grasping the difference between science, which is the empirical study of things that we can empirically study, and scientism, which is the philosophy that the only things that exist are things. In other words, that everything is material. Now, it's also known as naturalism. it's also, there's also a philosophy from that known as logical positivism, which says that the only things that can be proven to be true are those things which can either be logically deduced from mathematical principles or can be empirically demonstrated. Now, A.J. Ayer, who was the chief proponent of that philosophy in the 1920s, I loved it when in the 1970s, 50 years later, he was asked, what was wrong or what do you regret about your logical positivist philosophy? And he just wonderfully said it was rubbish. it was demonstrably false, because if the only things that are true are things that can be empirically proven, then that statement itself cannot be empirically proven. Therefore, it cannot be true.
Yeah.
So it kind of it hung itself. And I would say that the question that you're asking just now is based entirely upon a naturalistic presupposition. But it's a presupposition that you accept by faith. It's not one that you can prove.
Okay, but you could take it in a slightly less strong way, couldn't you? Mm. You could say, well, as scientists, I'm not a scientist, but if I was, I could say, well, I should use the method of methodological naturalism as a way of going about my science. So I should always privilege naturalistic explanations and say, well, look, I'm always going to put even the possibility of anything that's not material on the shelf and say that, well, I'm going to privilege all the time materialistic explanations. So is there any moment at which I could ever say, ah, well, I think God is the explanation, because I should always put it on the shelf, shouldn't I?
No, because what you're doing there, again, is now you spoke before about a logical fallacy. Hmm. There is a logical fallacy in what you're saying, mm-hmm. because you use naturalistic methodology to study naturalism. So the classic example would be, again, Lennox points this out, the kettle is on. Now, you can use naturalistic science to explain how the water boils, what the combination of water is, how electricity works, and so on. But until the cows come home, you will never get science to tell you why the kettle was put on, because you wanted to make a cup of tea for your granny. Scientism almost seems to say that science has no limitations, but science does have limitations. So science will tell me lots of things, but it actually cannot even tell me why science makes sense. Even Dawkins admits this. It takes Christianity or Islam, theism, we're not really onto Christianity yet. Theism as such, because the ancients, most of the world, for most of its history, believed that the universe was not ordered, that it was chaotic. It was only monotheists who believed that because there was a creator, an uncreated creator, going back to our earlier conversation, that they then said, well, the universe must be ordered. And if it's ordered, we can observe it. If we observe now, we can extrapolate back into the past. Mm-hmm. So empirical science depends actually upon theism.
I agree with you. And in fact, Stanley Jackie, the historian of science, makes a very persuasive case for that. But just coming back to your kettle business, yeah. You said that science will tell you the how the water is boiling, etc., but not the why the kettle is there. But so are you therefore saying that we can, through science, answer the how questions, perhaps fully, but leaving God just to the why questions? Is that right? So just why things exist?
Well, we'll never answer the how questions fully, I don't think, because there's always more to be discovered. Hmm. We can certainly answer considerably, but the why questions science just cannot answer for many, many, many things. And actually, it becomes the why purpose questions that are more important. So I can explain how I exist, but why I exist is even more important. Now, that's why you get people like Richard Dawkins saying, we don't care about why questions.
Isn't it a bit of a false distinction? Because, you know, you could ask the question, well, why am I here? And if you were a person who believed in evolution, you could say, well, I'm here because of evolution. That's the answer to the question of why I'm here.
Well, and if that's the only answer, then you're in a pathetic state, because you're just a bunch of chemicals going, as Bertrand Russell said, from one meaningless existence to another. Mm-hmm. So in actual fact, if I shoot you and kill you, all I'm doing is rearranging chemicals in the universe. It's no different from stepping on a gnat or pulling up a plant.
So you're saying that God can answer the kind of ultimate why questions. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, I would say that God can answer the how questions as well, but because he could answer them.
Right.
Well, but I'm saying that there isn't an answer through naturalism, or at least if there is an answer, it's an incredibly bleak and dreary one, which Dawkins himself argues. Again, I cite it in the Dawkins letters. The universe has all the properties that we would expect if there was no good, no evil, no beauty, and so on. Well, if that's the world you want to live in. But that's why atheistic naturalism is so depressing, and why any society which has ever sought to live according to its principles has destroyed itself.
Okay, so are you, in a sense, falling under Nietzsche's curse here? Because he would say to you, you know, you're not embracing the rugged truth, you see. You're just embracing that which you want to believe because you find it difficult.
Well, yes, Dawkins initially used to have the suck it up and see approach, which is why most atheists don't want to associate themselves with him now. You know, it's the truth. I actually admire him for that. I go with him with that. Like, go with what is the truth. But, I mean, the way I'll explain it is this. Nietzsche's curse, that's a good one. I mean, because he ended up mad. You know, he ended up mad. He also ended up being Hitler's favorite philosopher. You know, the strong man overcoming the weak and so on. So if you want to go that social Darwinianist route, and then fair enough. But I would argue the opposite. I remember I did a debate down at Cambridge University, and to be honest, we were on a hiding to nothing because it was the Cambridge Debating Society, and the motion they put was really unfair. This house believes there is a God. Well, so we were asked to prove God in debating terms.
Impossible, yeah.
Yeah, and I just thought, well, we'll lose this one. And one of my opponents stood up, and he was the head of the Atheist and Skeptic Society, I believe, or Atheists and Agnostics. And I couldn't believe it. He actually quoted Bertrand Russell, I think, who after the Second World War and the BBC Home Service said, Belsen is wrong, is not a fact. Belsen, the concentration camp like Auschwitz, yes. Is wrong, yes. Is not a fact. Right. And I had three opportunities to interrupt, so I took one of them. And he said, I thought you would, David. And I said, what, you don't believe that Belsen is wrong? He said, no, I believe it's wrong, but it's not a fact like gravity is a fact. And then he issued me a challenge. He said, can you prove Belsen is wrong? And I remember praying one of these wee arrow prayers, you know, that kind of goes up, Lord, help me here. And I thought, and then it just came to me. I mean, I'm not saying divine revelation, but it seemed so logical to me. I said, yeah, it depends on your starting point. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, your starting point is there's no God. So actually, when there's no God, like Richard Dawkins says, you have no absolute morality, so you can have no absolute right or wrong. So you cannot say that Belsen is wrong is a fact. It's your opinion. It's a societal construct and so on. And he said, yes, that's correct. And he says, but how do you prove it's wrong? And I says, well, I have a different starting point. And he said, well, your starting point is there is a God. I said, no. My starting point is Belsen is wrong. My starting point is if you go outside and rape my daughter, it's wrong. And then I ask, why is it wrong? I know it's wrong, but why is it wrong? And I keep asking, and I keep asking, and I keep asking, and I keep asking, and eventually I'll come up with God. So in actual fact, what you have just done is you've given us one of the chief proofs for God, the sense of right and wrong. We won the debate.
Did you really? Wow.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. On the vote, we won it. Wow. Because, he'd created a trap I hadn't even thought yes, of yes. for himself.
Yeah, I find it a very powerful argument. We had Glenn Peoples talking about it, actually. And, it was really interesting because, of course, he teased it apart in all its philosophical sophistication, etc. But, I mean, it's a really powerful set of arguments, I think. It leads me to kind of the other side of the coin, which, of course, a lot of people say, the Bible is immoral. Let me put this one to you. The Bible says that we are to treat others as we want them to treat us. But the Bible also assumes slavery is business as usual and treats it as moral. Well, isn't this hypocrisy on the part of the Bible?
No, it's probably hypocrisy on the part of the questioner. sorry. Well, I'll tell you why. Because we still have slavery today in different ways. You know, it depends. What do you call slavery? You know, also in the real world. So, I mean, these are people who say, well, if I lived in the first century and I'd been a Christian, I would have been telling the slaves to rise up and throw off their chains. Well, in the Roman Empire, we know there were about 60 million slaves. We know that the empire depended on it, and we know that if there had been that kind of thing, there would have been a bloodbath and the whole thing would have fallen apart. It's a bit like nowadays we think, Western liberal values are what everyone else wants. So if we invade Iraq and get rid of the bad guys, or Libya and get rid of the bad guys, then human beings will just rise up and it'll suddenly be turned into Paris. You know, not how it works. Not in the real world. We've made it far, far worse. So Jesus gives a very interesting perspective on this because he says, Moses said this because of the hardness of your hearts. And I think that what you find the Bible working with is pragmatic considerations. There was slavery in society. So how are you going to deal with it? And what does it mean? Slavery in the New Testament, for example, doctors were slaves. Now, it may be that there are doctors today because of Jeremy Hunt. They might say, we're slaves now. You know, in Marxism, we'd say wage slaves. But doctors were slaves. Teachers were often slaves. It's very different kinds of slavery. So I think that what you get is a kind of utilitarian approach. And what's very interesting, again, Richard Dawkins in The God Delusion, in talking about the Time Machine, H.G. Wells, the man who wrote the Time Machine, H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells at one point had said, what will happen to the Chinese and to the African? Well, I guess for the good of humanity, they'll have to go. And he was talking about the whole-scale annihilation of all Chinese and all Africans. And Dawkins says, well, that was the zeitgeist of the time, and we know better now, and we can't judge people by another zeitgeist. And he then goes on to judge the Bible when it's giving what I would say are, in certain situations, I mean, I don't accept that the Bible supports slavery. What I would suggest is it offers the only way out of slavery by saying that all human beings are created equally in the image of God. I think it argues against slavery.
Okay. So you are saying essentially then that God was accommodating to the culture as it was in the ancient world.
Yes.
But let me just quote, though, I mean, it could be argued that he could have done more. So let's look at, so this is the Mosaic commands. Here is Leviticus 25, 44 to 46, and I'll read this from the NIV. Quote, your male and female slaves are to come from the nations around you. From them you may buy slaves. You may also buy some of the temporary residents living among you and members of their clans born in your country, and they will become your property. Mm-hmm. You can bequeath them to your children as inherited property and can make them slaves for life. But you must not rule over your fellow Israelites ruthlessly, end quote. Now, it's the word ruthlessly there. It does imply that maybe you're allowed to rule over others ruthlessly.
No, what I would suggest is that we have lots of ruling over today as well. I think the problem with this that exists is it exists for the Christian because we're looking at standards of morality and so on that come down to us absolutely from God. I think the problem for the non-Christian is non-existent because they accept that all morality is relative. And if a society says it's moral, then it must be moral. So I don't accept that from non-Christians. And it's usually a very, very superficial knowledge. I think in that culture at that time, slavery was normal. Now, okay, it could be...
Let me just... Sorry to butt in there. But you say you don't accept it from non-Christians. But let me ask you, as a Christian... That does seem a rather strange thing for God to say. You may not rule over your fellow Israelite ruthlessly, but by implication, maybe it's okay to rule over others ruthlessly. Isn't that what God is saying?
No, I'm not sure that that's a fair implication at all. Mm-hmm. It's not then saying, like, for example, if I said to my son, you must make sure that you treat your sister well, your oldest sister well, he doesn't immediately think, that means I can treat my younger sister badly.
Okay.
You know, I think what you're doing is... putting two and two together and making five. I think, though, that what is being stated there, and you'll find that elsewhere, is a kind of national identification with God's people and all the rest of it. But I would be very, very careful about taking the Levitical code and saying this is an absolute law that applies to all of culture. I mean, I quite like, in my own church, we have a document, the Westminster Confession, which teaches that there's, in the Old Testament, the ceremonial law, the moral law, and the civil law. And it basically says the ceremonial law is gone because of the temple is gone and Christ has come. The moral law remains, but the civil law, the Mosaic law for the theocratic Israel, that no longer remains because we don't have that.
Hmm.
I find it really ironic that in a society which says it's against slavery, from which largely Christians were responsible for driving slavery out of Britain, Wilberforce and so on, that today we have more slaves in Britain than we've ever had. It's estimated there are 20,000 slaves in Britain. So the reintroduction of slavery in modern progressive Britain is, I think, indicative of what happens when you turn away from Christ.
Okay, I've got an evidence question here.
Okay.
So this is mostly a quote. Resurrection, walking on water, feeding a bunch of people with a loaf of bread, and turning water into wine. Why should we not think these supposed miracles are just made up by, quote, devious people to dupe the delusional naive? And there's a related thing here. Also, supposed miracles like these conveniently only happen in the past or will happen in the promised future. So isn't that further indication that they're all basically just made up?
Well,
there's a lot there.
Yeah, there's a lot there. G.K. Chesterton, the Roman Catholic writer, says that we believe in miracles because we have evidence for them. He says the unbeliever in miracles has a doctrine against them. And I think that's where that question is coming from. The questionnaire is presupposing that miracles don't happen. And, you know, supposing one happened in front of their eyes, they still wouldn't believe because they have a doctrine that says there must be another explanation. There must be another explanation. Actually, from a historical point of view, if I was wanting to invent a religion to dupe people, what I would not do is have the New Testament miracles because they're obviously laughable at one level.
Hmm.
And in some ways, they are counterintuitive because they're claiming things that happened, that you could go and see the people. There's a fascinating quote that I quote in Magnificent Obsession from late 1st century, maybe early 2nd century. A quote to the Emperor Quadratus saying, Jesus went around healing many people, and some of these people are still alive who you can interview.
Who was that from, did you say?
It may have been Marcion. I'm just trying to remember. I can't actually remember.
No problem.
But I know it was to the Emperor Quadratus. And I mean, it's an astonishing early statement. It's saying, some of whom are still alive.
Mm. Yes, Paul says that in 1 Corinthians 15, doesn't he, with respect to the resurrection experiences?
Yeah, he does. So, I mean, the thing about miracles, and in Magnificent Obsession, I have a whole chapter on miracles. If you believe that miracles don't happen, no matter what someone says, they don't happen. I happen to think that many Christians, and not just Christians, but many other people are completely gullible at this level.
Mm.
Because, you know, people claim, oh, it's a miracle. My daughter gets out of bed in the morning. That's a miracle. No, it's not. Scotland win the World Cup. That would be a miracle, actually. But it's not really. A miracle...
What about the birth of a new baby? Is it not justified to call that a miracle?
No, because it's a natural process. Mm-hmm. Miracles used too lightly. If we were defining miracle as a supernatural intervention into nature, into natural processes, then someone who believes that there is no supernatural, they're never, ever going to accept miracle, ever. The trouble is, too often we attribute something as being miraculous. For example, I was very, very, very seriously, I was supposed to die 5 years ago. I was in intensive care for 9 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And my surgeon afterwards said that I've been in surgery for 30 years, and there are only two people whose lives I cannot account for, and yours is one of them, David, and I regard you as being a walking miracle. He said, I have no reason why you're alive. I happen to believe it was in answer to prayer. I think God used the skill of the surgeon, medicine, and so on as well. Whether it was a direct miracle or not, I'm not sure. I think it's pretty miraculous, which is slightly different. But what I find interesting in the Bible is that miracles occur in periods. So you've got the period of Moses or Elijah and Elisha, and then Jesus and the apostles. And then you get whole periods when there aren't any like that. So I think the miracles of Christ were there to demonstrate who he was. They were witnessed by many people. They were testified to. Luke's gospel, for example, basically says, I've carefully investigated all of this.
But we can't, can we? He could, or at least he claims to.
No, but then...
So, but we can't. And if miracles don't happen today, why should we think they happened in the past?
But then you end up with a fallacy. The fallacy is, unless I can prove it, unless I see it, but that's a daft way to live life. I mean, I can't prove that a plane can fly. I don't know anything about, you know, aerodynamics and engineering and so on.
So I just have to trust the testimony of these people who wrote these documents a couple of thousand years ago.
Well, what you have to do is apply the same standard you would apply to anything else, which is you take an accumulation of evidence. You also have a degree of humility which recognizes that you cannot know or understand everything. And you then say, well, on the basis of... And I'm saying this as a historian. I think that the New Testament is highly historically attested. Absolute proof, no. But then you get absolute proof for nothing. I mean, there's nobody listening to this who can absolutely prove that there are minds that exist other than their own. There's nobody who can absolutely prove that the whole universe didn't come into existence yesterday. Nobody can absolutely prove that.
But wouldn't I need to have... You know, in terms of a rational argument, wouldn't I need to have an example of a miracle today to be able to say, well, I could compare it with this. I can see that happening in the past, and it's like this happening today, so maybe those two things meet.
No, because in terms of a rational argument, if you actually believed that there could be no such miracles, supposing a miracle did happen, you would find another explanation. So automatically, when I recovered, I mean, I thought it was quite funny because when I got out, there were hundreds and hundreds of cards that were waiting for me, actual written cards. Imagine that in this day of the email. I worked my way through some of them, and there was one, my favorite was from a couple of atheists who always argued against me. And they'd actually put, we're praying for you. And I wrote them and said, thank you guys, to whom?
Right.
But yeah. what I found really interesting in that whole context was my atheist friends who are convinced naturalists would say, well, what an incredible coincidence, or how fortuitous you were, or, you know, the skill of the surgeon. And I would say, well, the surgeon said it was a miracle. He said nothing to do with him. And whereas my Christian friends had no problem saying, we were praying for you, and look what happened.
You use the word intervention. Now, a lot of theologians don't like that, and they'll say, no, you really can't talk about God intervening in the created order to produce miracles, because after all, it is his world. He's made it, so why would he intervene? So they backtrack from that particular term. Do you think they're right to do that?
No, they're not right to do it at all. And I mean, theologians, but I would call them unbelieving theologians, because a bit like when the BBC did a program, I think it was about The Nativity, actually. Okay. And the man who produced it was one of the producers of EastEnders. And it was actually a brilliant program. And he was being interviewed about it. And he said he went and did some investigation. He went around all these theologians and he said, you know, they kind of mumbled about Mesopotamia, it didn't really happen, virgin birth doesn't really happen, da 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 da. Yeah. And he then said, and then he thought, he said, basically, I thought, you idiots, why not just believe what's there? And he actually told the story it was in the Bible because it was much more believable than all their alternative explanations. And I mean, yeah, they're the kind of people who go, well, Jesus didn't really feed 5,000 because what happened was the boy brought out his picnic and all these people had been hiding their picnics, so they brought out theirs and shared it with the people around them. And the purpose of this story is to show us that we share everything we've got. And you go, no, it's to show that Jesus is the Son of God because he took 5 loaves and 2 fishes and turned them into enough food to feed 10,000 people or whatever. Mm-hmm. Now, I would say the same with that. This world is broken. This world is polluted. Human beings are never going to fix it. If God does not intervene, then we're in trouble. And I find it really interesting that the same people who will say that will also turn around and say, well, why doesn't God do something? We're going to say, well, wait a minute, you just complained that he did do something. And he has, and he will. So, you know, honestly, they're as much theologians as I am a quantum physicist.
Okay, well, I won't ask you any questions about that then. Are you all right for time, by the way?
Yeah, I'm okay. Yeah, sure.
Okay, good. Because I wanted to ask you a quirky question just before we'll just sort of take a hiatus. I don't know what you're going to make of this one, but it did come in. Does, I couldn't hardly say it, actually. Does God look away when people have sex or go to the washroom?
Yeah, it's a quirky question, which if the prophet Elijah was talking about the prophets of Baal, he'd be making fun of them. And that's what this person's seeking to do. This person's seeking to be smart and to try and make fun because they're treating God as a human being. And the answer to that is no, no, and no. Why are you so Puritan? Because you're regarding sex as being dirty. Mm. You're also not recognizing that God is omnipresent, omniscient, and so on, way beyond our understanding or knowledge, and not like us in that sense at all. So the question is trying to be smart, but fails miserably.
Okay, fair enough. I thought I'd ask anyway, because it did come in.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, let's just take a bit of a break here from the formal questioning. I just wanted to ask you really, you know, from all the talking you do, the various venues you go to, do you really find that there is a lot of interest in the gospel? And the reason why I'm asking this is because, you know, I do some preaching in mainstream churches, Methodist, URC and the like, and, you know, not really a lot of people who are unchurched even come into that context. And of course, here at the website as well, I find that I don't get a huge number of emails saying, you know, can you tell me more about the gospel? I do get some. So, I mean, do you find that there's much interest in your travels?
Oh, yeah, totally. In fact, we have a kind of wee mantra with Solace that I would say I've been in ministry for 30 years. And I would say that people in Britain are more open to the gospel now than they have been for 30 years. Wow. And the church is less prepared to communicate it. Hmm. That would be my argument. I mean, those are generalizations, of course. But yeah, absolutely.
So people really do want to know, but the churches are not equipped.
Well, a lot of people don't want to know.
Right.
And some people think they want to know. And when you tell them, they get really annoyed because that's not what they want to know. Hmm. You know, there is a lot of apathy, but I used to think it was just complete apathy. But after I did the Dawkins letters, what astounded me, not just that it became a bestseller, but I mean, Borders bookstores, when they existed, told me, for example, that my tour of their bookshops had been their most popular tour, certainly in Scotland. I mean, I'm not a well-known author, and the reason for that is just simply it's the subject. So, for example, I went to the Borders store in the Bullring in Birmingham, and I turned up and the manageress had me downstairs in the basement with 10 chairs. And I said, you're going to need more than that. And she looked at me and she smiled. And I said, you don't believe that, do you? I said, why? And she said, well, look, we had Lawrence Delaggio, the England rugby captain, here last week, 50 people. We had Nigella, our number one book here, and we had 50 people. And you, and I said, yeah, I'm an unknown Presbyterian pleb from Scotland. I said, but it's not me, it's the subject. I said, and there's two churches that have organized this, so I think you'll have at least 40 or 50. Well, 150 people later, she called in security. And afterwards, she said to me, David, that was an incredible, well, first of all, one incredible evening. Once I got over the shock of how many people were there, I thought, okay, but it's rent a mob from the church. And then your questions, every question was hostile to you. And I realized it wasn't. And I said to her, well, to be honest, about half of them were from the church. But you're right, the other half weren't. And she said, I can't believe that people are this interested. And she told me something that was really funny. She says, you know what I'm going to do for Christmas? I'm going to bundle your book and Dawkins' book together as a special offer.
Oh, lovely. When you say half of the people were from the church, presumably it wasn't because you told them to be there.
No, they were. The churches had organized it and said to people, you know, I mean, we were, as I mentioned that you mentioned the Tesco's thing before. I was in Coat Bridge and over 100 people turned up.
Right. So it wasn't like some sort of covert PR campaign or anything like that.
No. I mean, you don't. Okay. I've gone to political meetings and lots of other meetings where there's half a dozen people. I find not everywhere I go, but in a lot of places, there's great interest in this. I mean, I've spoken to packed cafes, libraries, pubs, lots of things. I mean, if you're asking people to come into church, that's slightly different.
Mm.
Yeah. It's very, very different. Yeah. Oh, no, there's tremendous interest. Now, I would still argue that there is apathy. I would still argue that there's hostility. But, you know, it's so funny because God was supposed to be dead. And when I did the Dawkins letters, I discovered this. Richard Dawkins had written The God Delusion months, perhaps years before it was published.
Oh, really?
And his publisher had said, wait till the right moment. Wait till the right moment.
Uh-huh.
And he was the moment they were waiting for was when George Bush became unpopular in the US, really.
Ah, that's interesting.
And as soon as that happened, it was released. And it was to tap in, not to get Christians, but it was to tap into all these latent atheists. But one of the reasons that Dawkins wrote that book was because in the 1960s, 1970s, it was just believed religion would die out. The Economist, in its millennial edition in 2000, published an obituary for God. I think it was 7 years later, or it may have been 11 years later. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the 2011, actually, edition. The Economist published a 16-page apology entitled God Returns to Europe. And what you find is that Dawkins, for example, was furious. I got an email from two people who, to this day, I still won't name, because they said, don't tell the boss, but we're Richard Dawkins students, and, you know, kind of in Oxford and all the rest of it. And they said, we believe in God. And there's a lot more of us. And I think that Dawkins was getting more and more furious that in universities he was coming across more and more people who still believe.
And yet,
possibly increasing them.
Well, and yet the media is constantly giving us the impression that faith is on the decline, because they point to the decline in denominational attendance and things. Anyway, I don't want to go away from this subject, because I want to go straight into the next question, which is directly connected to this, just to see how you respond to it. I think I should ask it because it has been sent to me. So in the last decade or so, we've seen the rise of the so-called new atheists, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, late Christopher Hitchens, who've written, spoken and debated effectively, but not necessarily always reasonably, and encouraged a confidence in people to challenge religious belief in general and perhaps Christianity in particular. So, coupled with the general trend towards secularism, are the days of Christianity, at least in the West, numbered?
No. I mean, it's quite funny, really, because, I mean, people will say that. I mean, I'll give you an example. I'm sitting in my church office just now in Dundee. Mm-hmm. It's a church that I came to in 1992. There were seven people, and four of them left when I came. So it was what we call a Scottish revival. And last Sunday, we had over 300, and mostly younger people. Hmm. You know, it's not dead at all. The church in London is growing. There are different things. I think what's happening is Christendom has gone, and I personally think that's probably a bad thing.
A bad thing?
I think it's a bad thing for the rest of society. I think the poor especially will suffer because of that. Christendom has gone, and the kind of institutionalized Christianity will hang on for a long time because it's got resources and money and, to some degree, an element of political and state patronage. But I think those churches will die. I think churches that turn away from the Bible will die. Churches which hold on to the Bible but are legalistic will die. I think churches which say they hold on to the Bible but are exploitative and so on will explode. But I do think that churches which hold to the Bible, follow the Christ of the Bible, will find that they are both loved and hated in equal measure, and they'll grow.
What do you think about the emergent church movement? Do you think that's the future?
No. The emergent church will disappear as quickly as all the other fads that have been in the church will disappear. It's an attempt to try and keep up with the culture, and it's an attempt to try and justify lots of other things that go. I mean, all these phrases get used. I mean, God can use anything. My view is that God can use a donkey, so he can use me and anybody else.
And me, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, that for me, I don't dispute that. And the emergent church may be tapping into things that are right, maybe correctly critiquing some aspects of the church and all the rest of it. But there isn't an emergent church or whatever. There's the Church of Jesus Christ, and there are basics about that. And the great thing about the Church of Jesus Christ, it's so adaptable and flexible.
But you would say a lot of the ideas of the emergent church are essentially compromising, and that's why they were going to go the way of all flesh?
Yes, it'll happen for a while. I mean, I remember we had somebody from an emergent type church in my own city. They came to us and they said, you know, we did community church and it was wonderful and so on. And I said, you closed, what was wrong? He says, yeah, well, we did the community bit quite well, but we forgot about the Bible. Yeah, and I've seen that so many times. My concern is that we far too often fall into a Western individualistic aspect in which we try and create churches in our own image. Hmm. I mean, I don't have that option here. I have people come into my church from all different backgrounds. I don't get to pick and choose who belongs to the church. But I think we're creating churches for particular groups. And I suspect emergent churches are just that. They're churches that suit people of a particular temperament, a particular age, a particular culture, a particular class. You know, I don't think sitting around drinking lattes is Christianity.
Okay, well, that segues a little into this next question, which is, I suppose, connected to groupthink, perhaps. Anyway, this is a listener's question, but it's also something I would like to ask you. And it's something that concerns many people who listen to this show, because they, you know, they send in emails expressing their frustrations that they can't find a church that will take various of their concerns seriously. So this is a kind of sociological question I'm putting to you. So here's the question, right? Why are the churches, by and large, so politically conventional and establishment in their thinking? I'm just going to give you a bit of focus for this. So, you know, many people, I would say probably millions of people, have genuine concern that there's an increasing level of propaganda in the mainstream media actually directed towards us as citizens. We're not actually being told the truth about a variety of subjects. I won't say, you know, which subjects, but nevertheless, there is this sense that there are things that we are being not told the truth about. And yet, and this is my experience too, so many people in the churches seem unwilling even to talk about matters like that. Why do you think that is?
Oh, because we're cowards. And we're far too nice. You know, we're just dreadfully English, even says he, the Scottishman, you know, but dreadfully British then, let's say that. Too often we're there to maintain the church. We don't want to upset anyone. Also, sometimes we don't know because it's just too big. We don't do big picture stuff well. We don't want to get involved in kind of fundamentalist right-wing politics. We don't want to get involved in fundamentalist communist politics or whatever. But there's also a kind of pietism which says, well, if we just tell people about Jesus and he's nice, then eventually everything else will sort itself out. Whereas my view is if you're teaching through the Bible, it'll be very different. I found, for example, a couple of Sundays ago I was preaching on Psalm 72, which is about, you know, the king will come and give righteousness and shalom, peace, and, you know, it deals with a whole bunch of different things. It is ultimately talking about Christ. It's a messianic psalm, but it is also talking about King Solomon. It's one of the ones we know he wrote, and it's saying this is what government should look like. Mm-hmm. I mean, I preached on that. I gave loads of examples of where there was unrighteousness in the world. From everything from aborting Down's baby syndromes to Syrian refugees to all that kind of stuff. And there were Christians who objected.
Right.
Because they thought it was, I mean, I'm a Bible-believing, evangelical, Calvinist, Reformed, Westminster Confession Christian. But they thought, oh, no, this is not right. You know, you shouldn't be. But I mean, I was giving examples of unrighteousness from a wide area. So I think on the one hand, you've got churches which will mention things like abortion, but don't mention other things like poverty and so on. You get other churches that mention poverty and don't mention sexual morality issues, or if they do, do so in an unbiblical way. And people get very, very confused. They think, you know, you've got left-wing churches, you've got right-wing churches, and so on.
Oh, this is what I find, that people seem to be quite happy to talk in party political terms.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of old-fashioned, really, because, you know, if I bring up something like, here are a couple of examples of things that we actually have talked about on the show. For example, the TTIP, a Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and these disgusting investor-state dispute settlement clauses that are in there that could allow corporations to sue governments because they thought they were going to make more money, then they turned out not to make more money because the policies of the country changed, you know, that sort of thing. And also extremism disruption orders, which are causing a lot of concern to people that they're going to, you know, catch people just for preaching the gospel, etc. I've tried to talk about this myself with people in the church, and there's shut off straight away. And I think, well, oh, because it's not party politics. But this is actually where the rubber hits the ground, isn't it? You know, this is real politics.
Well, it is. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I find it interesting. I try not to figure watch in terms of what I write in my blog, because otherwise you end up trying to write then to get people to read, you know, to get the numbers. But by far, and I mean by far, the most read article I've ever written was called The Tipping Point, ironically, which was about TTIP and the European referendum.
Right.
And I wrote explaining why I'd come out in favor of Brexit, even though I would class myself as basically, well, no, I better be careful what I say. I was going to say I'd class myself as basically left-wing, you know, and all this kind of stuff. Now, the difference is in my church, I don't preach politics from the pulpit, and I never will.
Okay.
So I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, that's a different issue.
That is a different issue. But I mean, I think what I do try and do is show to people that what I would call a holistic view of salvation and a holistic view of thing is that you don't want church and politics. You do not want what's happened in the United States, where the church has become identified with one particular type of right-wing politics. You don't want that. You don't want it right or left or whatever. You absolutely do not want that.
No, no.
But then you don't want the kind of pietism. And then the other thing we need to look at, I mean, a fascinating thing was I heard a minister of a church in England being interviewed on Radio 4 on the European thing. He said, I don't know anyone in my church or in my circles who voted to leave. And I looked at his constituency and it was like 45% voted to leave. And I thought, wow, what group are you not touching? Because I'm looking at my church and there were people who were passionate about staying in the EU, people who were passionate about leaving, people who couldn't care less, people who didn't know. We've got passionate Scottish nationalists and passionate unionists. And to me, that's what the church should be. But I want people thinking about these things from a Christian perspective, not saying, look, this is the Christian view on how much income tax you should pay. This is the Christian view on whether Scotland should be independent or whether you should be in the EU. I mean, I specifically stated there isn't a Christian view on whether we should be in the EU. But as a Christian, this is why I'm arguing what I'm arguing.
So you're saying that you actually knew what people were thinking in your congregation?
Oh, yes.
Well, how do you therefore create such a freedom within the congregation, which is what I'm not experiencing in the churches that we attend?
Because I think that what's happening is there are unvoiced expectations that people have. So when that man said, I don't know anyone in our circles, I'm saying you're not reaching people. So I would want within my – I mean, because I don't teach party politics, but I want people who are, you know, out-and-out socialists. I want people who are Jeremy Corbyn supporters, people who are Scottish nationalists, people who are Tories or whatever – to know that they are welcome here. And that includes – I also want people of different cultures and all the rest of it. And I want people to discuss these things.
Yes. But how do you create that in your congregation? What do you actually do to encourage that or not to discourage it anyway?
Well, I would suggest that the focus of the worship services is teaching the word of God and prayer and so on. But we have a strong community, a lot of community stuff. And there's other stuff that, you know, writing and talking and, for example, on the political side, our church is a polling station. And we also use it to have kind of question time events with all prospective MPs when the elections come.
Right.
So there's things like that that occur politically. But I'm also concerned about things like the National Health Service, education and so on. So we have a lot of doctors, a few teachers. We're looking at the whole question of education from a Christian perspective.
Okay.
You know,
so you're modeling it in a way, aren't you? You're actually out there engaging with political issues in the widest sense, and people can see what you're doing and they're encouraged by what you model.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm in the secular press. I'm in the secular press quite a lot on a variety of issues. I mean, I deliberately said I do not want to be the guy who's always quoted as being against same-sex marriage, which I am, but I don't want that to be just our sole focus. So we've spoken about many different issues, but we do it in a way, I hope, which doesn't say we're saying this is what God says. We're trying to say this is how we're applying our Christianity in this context. If we're wrong, let us know. I think openness is a good thing. I mean, people go on about being open and tolerant, but I suspect they're not really. You know, there's always a code. There's always something else. And I think if your unity, if you're focused on Christ and his word, then it allows you to disagree about things that are important but are peripheral at one level. You know, for me, that's very, very important.
Fascinating.
Creating a kind of open community where you can have disagreement about secondary issues to the kingdom.
Yeah. Well, absolutely fascinating. I just wish that we were in a context which would allow that, but it doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, we try. I'm not sure we've got there. I'm not sure we've got there. We try, and I mean, we have our problems as well. And, you know, I mean, every church is full of sinners, as you know, I get lots and lots of things wrong. But I must admit, I do like the freedom I've got here, and I'll never give that up. I mean, I would resign before I give up that freedom.
Wonderful. Are you okay for a couple more questions?
Yeah, two more, and then
All right, okay. Well, I've got a kind of logic stroke theology one, and then a quirky one to end with. So, if God is able to create human beings and even resurrect people from the dead, how come God was unable to stop Jesus dying on the cross?
Well, he wasn't unable to stop him dying on the cross,
but he didn't.
He didn't. That's different. That's a different question. Why did he let Jesus die on the cross? Well, he gives that answer. God handed him over, it says. It was by God's set purpose and foreknowledge. He was given as the atoning sacrifice for our sins. So it's not as though God was looking and going, oh no, my son's been crucified. I wasn't expecting this to happen. The whole thing was set up.
So God wanted Jesus to die on the cross?
Yes, absolutely.
But isn't that terribly cruel?
Yes, if it wasn't for the fact that the son agreed to go. And it wasn't done as some kind of sadistic reason. He did it in order to save us. So it's the equivalent of if I had a son and I'm on the wonderful banks of the River Tay here in Dundee, and I say to my son, go jump in the river, son, and he drowns. That's really cruel. But if, on the other hand, there are 10 people drowning and I say to my son, son, jump in the river, you can rescue those people, and he does, and then he drowns. That's a world of difference. It's a world of difference.
Okay.
So I would say exactly the same. It's a world. God so loved that he gave his only begotten son.
And do you think the doctrine of the incarnation is important at that moment as well, that it's actually God himself who does it?
Yes. I think the doctrine of the incarnation is vital. The doctrine of the atonement is vital. I mean, all these are central doctrines to the Christian faith. Mm. And I think there is a sense in which Paul speaks in Acts of God's blood. God doesn't have blood. But he did in Christ. Jesus is Emmanuel, God with us. In that sense, God became human, had a human body, human emotions, human soul, and died carrying human sin.
This gets over the objection that God is this cosmic child abuser, because in fact it's God who does this himself, as far as the doctrine of the incarnation is concerned.
Yes.
But let me just push this a little further, if I may. This isn't quite the question, but I think this is what somebody would say coming back to you as well. Okay, so this is what God wanted to happen because in order to save people. What? How on earth does that work?
Well, I think it works very straightforwardly. In a moral universe, which I believe in, I don't believe in the amoral universe of Dawkins and co. In a moral universe, there's right and wrong. Auschwitz is wrong. Raping a child is wrong, and all these different kinds of things. And all actions have consequences. So I went to see the film Anthropoid recently, which is about the assassination of Heydrich in Prague in 1942. Brilliant film, by the way. Highly recommended to absolutely anyone. Beautifully filmed, beautifully done. But at one point, and I mean, it's not a plot spoiler to say that, you know, Heydrich dies, and of course the people who kill him, are there's terrible vengeance taken on them. But at one point, some of the partisans are hiding in the cathedral in Prague, and they're talking with the priest and saying, you know, what is the point of all this? You know, we kill Heydrich and then the Nazis will just do this. We wonder what the point is. And the priest says, their day will come, in effect. He says, there is a day of justice coming. And so I believe absolutely that there's a day of justice coming. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately for me, that day of justice means I've got to pay for my sin, the things I've done that are wrong. And there are many things. And all human beings would have to pay for that. Mm-hmm. Now, the only way that I could pay for them is I can't do enough good works to kind of make up for the bad stuff. So I can either perfectly obey God's law or someone can do it for me. And Jesus perfectly obeyed God's law for me, but also paid for my sin, because what he did on the cross was he suffered the punishment that was due to me. It's a great exchange. It's the substitution. Basically, when I stand before God and, you know, I'm found guilty of so many things and the sentence is passed, the sentence has already been carried out.
Yeah. But doesn't this confuse crime and punishment with debt and payment? You know, if you commit a crime, then you deserve a punishment. So how can someone pay for somebody else's punishment? I mean, it isn't the settling of a debt, is it? It's actually taking somebody else's deserved punishment. That doesn't seem to satisfy justice.
Well, it is. I mean, up here, anyway, when we pray the Lord's Prayer, we say, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Forgive us our sins as we forgive those who sin against us, is what other people say, or transgressions and so on. And I think debt and debtors is actually a pretty good way. When we sin, we're primarily sinning against God. It's something we owe him. So in actual fact, I think almost every crime involves some kind of debt.
So what kind of debt are we talking about?
What's the great hymn? He paid a debt he did not owe. I owed a debt I could not pay. We're talking about the duty that we have to do what is right, to love, to achieve what is beautiful, and we don't do it. Instead, we go the ugly route, we sin, we cause harm, and we owe not just God, if you like, but also the rest of the world, our fellow humanity. We sin. I mean, if you accept the doctrine of sin, there's not a problem. I think the problem
comes... what do we owe him? What is it we owe him? We don't owe him money.
No, we owe him obedience, we owe him love, we owe him that we're made in his image, we owe him looking after his creation. There are many, many things that we owe him. Just as like my family, I owe my family. I don't primarily owe them money. I owe them love, I owe them respect, I owe them care, and so on.
Okay.
And if I don't do that, then I'm sinning against them, if you like. And I think in the same way, we have a far greater debt to God than we have to anybody else.
So Jesus somehow pays this debt of right living by dying on the cross. How does that satisfy a sense of justice that he who is not, he's not us, how does his death actually make that exchange?
Well, the Bible explains it, whether people accept it or not. It says, first of all, it turns aside the wrath of God. In other words, again, a lot of people don't accept this, but God is rightly angry with the mess that we made. I mean, I remember Freddie Mercury of Queen at Live Aid, the original Live Aid. I'm old enough to remember it. I remember him standing up and singing just with a guitar, an acoustic guitar, and he began this song, "If there's a God up above, a God of love," and I was thinking, oh no, here we go. You know, it's God. Why does God allow starving in Ethiopia and so on? And then much to my astonishment, he sang, "Then what must he think of the mess that we've made of the world that he created?" And I thought, wow, that's unbelievable. That was just sung in front of 50 million people, you know, and it's true. So, I mean, how it's paid is, first of all, the punishment that's due is taken by Christ. But also, it's not just that he takes the punishment. It's as though he takes our filthy rags and he gives us his clothes of righteousness. So the righteousness that's required is his. So I stand, if you like, before God, clothed in the righteousness of Christ, not my own, but his. And that's just the great exchange. And that's why Christianity works, especially amongst the poor. That's why, for example, I can go to a prostitute and say, look, I don't care what you've done. You can stand in the righteousness of Christ. You don't stand on your own. The kind of nice middle-class church-going person who, you know, gives regularly to Oxfam and wouldn't harm a fly is going to say, well, wait a minute, I'll stand in my own righteousness. I remember Polly Toynbee in The Guardian reviewing the Narnia films saying it's horrendous, it's horrible that, you know, C.S. Lewis would think that I needed somebody to die for me. I've never done anything that bad. And I'm just going, well, I have. You know, I know who I am and I know what I need. And Christ meets that need. And that's the wonderful, if you like, apologetic that we have. There isn't a single person I go to for whom Christ is not enough.
Well, I agree with you, but, you know, I have to say, I think the atonement is a kind of, it's like a study area in itself, isn't there? There's so much actually to go into in order to make
it's the
sense
heart,
of it. But, you know, it's a constant project.
It is. Well, and especially in the worldview that we have. But I mean, I'll say this again. It's the very heart of the gospel.
Yes, I agree.
It's why it's so offensive to people, because it batters their pride. And it's really offensive to religious people, actually. It's why it's so offensive to people. And it's also why Christ is so attractive to people.
Okay, well, let's end on a quirky one. You don't mind, do you?
No, not at all. No, I love quirky.
I've got two to choose from here, and I'm trying to think, which one shall I ask?
Choose both. Do both. Let's do both.
Oh, quick. Go on. Go on.
And then do both.
One will be pretty quick. Okay, so here's the quick one. How does it make sense to say that God exists if he doesn't occupy any space?
Okay. Oh, well. Well, first of all, I mean, philosophically, if you're wanting to say the only things that can exist are things that occupy space, you are then saying that the only things that can exist are material things, and you then fall into the fallacy of naturalism. So that's the serious answer. I'll mind you, another serious one would just simply be this, to say that actually God does, he's everywhere. In the words of the songwriter, he's everywhere and nowhere, baby.
Okay, here's the other quirky one then. So Christians often say that it's because of what Adam did in the Garden of Eden that human beings are in trouble with God and need to be saved by Jesus. But isn't it really petty of God to be so angry with Adam just for eating a fruit from a particular tree?
Well, that's the interesting thing, because he wasn't angry with him just for eating the fruit from a particular tree. Mankind was created to be in fellowship with God. Part of that was that we have the right to choose between good and evil. If we're going to love, there has to be a choice. We cannot be like Henry T. Ford, who said of his Model T car, you can have any color you want as long as it's black. If God had created us so that we could only love him, it wouldn't be love, because there would be no choice. So there had to be a choice. The choice then involves a test where God says, you can have anything that you want, but you've got to leave that one. That, of course, is where the temptation came in. So it wasn't, oh, you ate some fruit like you nicked it out of a supermarket or something. Yeah. It is a specific command gone against a holy God. And from that point, it's not that God says, right, the rest of the human race, because of that one, it's not an apple, but that one fruit, you know, that's it. The fact is, Revelation describes it perfectly. It just says simply, the dead are judged according to what they're done. So if any of your listeners are saying, do you know this? I'm quite happy to stand before God in the day of judgment and be judged by what I've done. I'm saying you have no idea. You have no idea. I'm not happy to stand before God and say, look at me, look what I did. I'm looking and saying, no, forget what I did. Look at what Jesus did.
Yeah.
That's actually not a quirky question. I think it's a brilliant question. Yeah.
Sorry, I mean, just part of it could be seen in a quirky kind of way. It's very one-dimensional, I think, you know, just looking at the story that's there in Genesis and just taking it completely at face value and not seeing that it's actually talking about something far bigger than just the story in itself.
That's someone basically, I think, trying to ridicule. It's like Kerrang. This is, you're a slightly different radio thing from Kerrang. I did a Kerrang heavy metal station phone me up one time and asked me to do a discussion with them, which I thought, first of all, I thought it was a joke, but actually it was for real. Uh-huh. And the presenter, when he began, he played some music and then he said, well, there's a bit of Black Sabbath and we've got some Led Zepp coming up now, and we've got this really trendy vicar called Dave who wrote a book about Richard Dawkins. And I'm going, oh, this guy's an idiot. What have I got myself into?
I'm just wondering what he thought of me when I was introducing them.
Then he said, well, he didn't give that introduction. And then he said the most amazing thing. He said, so Dave, do you believe in talking snakes? And I knew instantly then I was in for the hardest half hour of my life. The guy was brilliant. He knew his Bible. He was serious. It was a most fascinating and engaging discussion. And he actually told me, or the producer told me afterwards, well, I've never seen anything like that, Dave. He said, our guy is real smart. And, you know, he said, you held your own with him. I mean, I was struggling at some points. The producer actually said to me, you know, Dave, there's a million people will have heard this.
Wow, great.
I was going, wow, you know. So, as I say, it's been great talking to you anyway.
Well, I can say for sure, you will not have a million people listening to this, but I'm sure however many thousand do, they will be very impressed by what you've done today, because I am in total awe that you can hold your own, especially when it comes to off-the-cuff questions that I just throw at you like this, because as I say before, you had no idea whatsoever what I was going to ask you. I just wish I had that ability as well, but I do not have that ability, but there you go.
I'm very limited, actually. It's a strange kind of thing. I mean, I'll just say this about how God brought me into this. In the 1980s, I was at Edinburgh University and I was very involved in student politics, and I did a lot of question and answer speaking, debating, heckling, and so on. And then all that stopped. I ended up going in for the ministry. 20 years later, I wrote the Dawkins letters and I stood up in Borders in Dundee in front of a microphone, an audience of about 50, which grew to about 100, spoke for 20 minutes, and then people started firing questions. And as I stood there, I just thought, do you know this? I was made for this. This is the one thing I can do. I'm a very limited person, I think.
You're very modest.
I mean, I know I can write, but I think on my feet pretty quickly. I'm just trying to be honest. You know, I know I do. And I love engaging with people in that kind of public forum. And I remember going home saying, Lord, that was brilliant. I'm going to do this. I know I'm going to do this. But why 20 years? Why didn't I start off my ministry doing this stuff? And the answer came immediately, not a voice from heaven, but just instinctively I knew, because you would have been an arrogant so-and-so. You know, it would have come across really horribly. But now you've had 20 years experience of, you've buried dead children, you've sat with drug addicts, you've had churches go wrong, you've got things wrong yourself. You've learned so much from experience. For 20 years, I've been reading widely without ever using it, just thinking and thinking and thinking, but also engaging with people as a pastor. And all of a sudden, I find myself on a public stage, although personally, I prefer doing it on a one-to-one basis or in a kind of cafe situation where people ask questions. And it's incredible how it works. I mean, I'm so thankful. The Lord is, because of Richard Dawkins, for example, I reckon that over 30,000 people who would never come to church have heard me speak the gospel in public or being able to be involved, you know, and with the written stuff and your kind of stuff, who knows how many more.
So thank God for Richard Dawkins. I don't think I'd ever hear anybody say absolutely. That, to be honest.
Absolutely. Oh, no, I mean, I know people who've been converted through him.
Wow.
So, yeah. I mean, oh, absolutely. But it's been a pleasure to talk to you, actually.
It has, and you did it all with man flu. That's incredible.
I know. I'm actually, you may hear me sucking on strepsils at the moment. And
yes, I did. I wonder what that was.
I'm going back.
Perhaps you had false teeth.
No, I'm going back to the old Scottish remedy, and I'm sorry if any strict Baptists are listening to this, malt whiskey and lemon and honey.
Oh, I say, wonderful. Right, okay. Just before we close, can you direct people to your blog? Because I haven't got the address here.
Yeah, it's straightforward because it's www.theweeflea, says he. Just checking. I better
check. .com.
Yeah, I think it's .com. I'm just checking.
.com. Lovely. Okay, well, thank you ever so much for coming on. It has been a delight speaking to you, and do hope one day to be able to speak to you again. Great.
Great. Come and visit us in Dundee sometime.
Lovely.
Great being with you.
Thank you ever so much.
God bless you. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Julian.